Hello, and welcome to Poetry in the Air, a Right Attitude radio show. This program is brought to you by the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative that enhances student learning by fostering positive attitudes toward writing. I am your host, Sierra Walton. Today, in honor of National Poetry Month, our show will feature three poets who visited Savannah State University as part of the 2015-2016 Georgia Poetry Circuit, Margot Shilp, Jeff Mock, and Andrea Hollander. We will also showcase poetry from members of the SSU community. To start us off, we'll listen to excerpts from a lecture given by Margot Shilp and Jeff Mock at Savannah State in November 2015. The two poets, who are married with two daughters, both teach at Southern Connecticut State University. Their poetry has appeared in numerous journals across the country, and they have each published multiple books. During their lecture at SSU, they spoke about the importance of writing in their lives, among many other topics related to their experiences as poets and editors.
My name is Jeff Mock. I'm a Midwesterner. I was raised in Iowa. My father and his family are from Valdosta, Georgia. So I spent some time in Georgia when I was young, and a little bit into northern Florida. Got to go out on a pontoon on the Okefenokee, right up to one of the springs, and it was crystal clear. It was absolutely beautiful. My father would always regain his southern accent within two or three days of being in Valdosta. We're here to talk about writing. I'm probably going to say some of the things you hear professors saying about the importance of writing. And the first thing I'm going to just say about writing is you are all probably right here, not in this room, but at this school, because you want professional positions. You know, you don't want to be working laborer. I think I got lucky. I could be a carpenter right now, and there's nothing wrong with being a carpenter. I still like to use my hands.
You're a really good carpenter.
Thank you. And that would be a good way to make a living, but I really do like writing. This is what defines me in part. In addition to being husband and father and a pretty decent driver. And so writing is part of my identity. It's part of who I am. And it's valuable in that kind of daily function in a professional life. So you're here because you want to be professionals. You want to get that job that you're going to be good at, that you're going to contribute to the community, that you're going to be able to rise in. There's an opportunity for promotion, advancement, opportunity to make money, some money to live with. And I just want to say that the way most people get that professional job is they have to write a letter. That's the first thing that you need to do. And I've been on hiring committees, and it's so easy to set a letter aside because it's not well written. So on a very fundamental level, being a good writer is important in that first step. I think in a larger way, writing helps us know ourselves and know the world. It helps us make sense of things. Every good writer I know is also a really good clear thinker. And that's not to say that only writers are good clear thinkers. I know lots of people who are good clear thinkers who are not good writers. But if you're a good writer, you are, sort of by definition, a good thinker. And so it's valuable. It never comes easy. I've met people that I think, oh, you're just a natural writer, and then they tell me how much they had to work at it. I had to work at it a lot myself, and in fact, I'm still working at it. Part of my writing process is the first thing I do is get it wrong. And then I have to go back, and I keep working on it, and I'm trying to find the right words to put these thoughts, these emotions, these images in. And so I get it wrong first, and then over time I work to get it right or somewhat right.
My name's Margot, my last name is Shilp. I didn't grow up in Iowa, I grew up in Illinois. I went to the university in my hometown. My dad taught at the university, and my mom was a journalist. So writing was always pretty important in my family. And I identify myself now as a writer, but I didn't always. I've always sort of thought of myself as, originally I wanted to go into sociology. I thought that was really interesting, and I took a lot of classes in sociology, and ultimately decided I couldn't get through the statistics course because I'm really not that good at math. But I took a creative writing class in college, and then took a few more and realized I really love writing. And even though when I say I love writing, I don't love the hard parts of writing, which is most of it. I like, you know, when it's finished. So I guess I don't really like the writing part of things. I like after the writing part of things. Because writing, I think everybody in this room probably could agree, it's really hard. You know, I teach writing, I teach composition, and I also teach creative writing. And my students very often come into classes feeling really unsure of themselves as writers, either because they've had bad experiences in classes, they've had teachers who've said, you know, horrible things to them, rather than being encouraging. And I think encouragement is pretty important to writers. You know, we slam ourselves enough, you know, oh, I'm a horrible writer, you don't need other people telling you that. So, yeah, I spend some time teaching writing, do my own writing. I guess one of the things we'd like to do today, one of the things I wanted to do was to talk about the way in which a poem comes about. And the poem that I want to talk about has to do with the narrative of the poem essentially is about my father dying. And most of the time, I'm not sure I could really talk about the process of writing something as specifically as I can about this particular poem, because this particular poem that I want to, I think I'll read it to you, it's not very long, and then I want to talk about writing it because it deviated pretty dramatically from the way I usually write poems. And I guess I wanted to use that as a way of talking about how, you know, allowing yourself some latitude when you're trying to write things. You know, if you're trying one thing and it's not working very well, you want to think about maybe trying something else because, you know, maybe you'll have success if you approach the problem from another way. Thank you. So generally, my composition process is very different than it was with this poem. For some reason, wanted to write a poem. This was after written maybe about 3 or 4 months after my father died. And I was thinking back on what a great life my parents have given me. I love my parents, I'm adopted. And I also sometimes think what a different life I may have had if they hadn't adopted me. And so I wanted to kind of, that's not in the poem, but I kind of wanted to honor my dad in that way. He was a really good dad, you know? And so I had in the back of my mind for a while that I wanted to write a poem about my dad. And this is the poem, I'll read the poem and then I can talk a little bit about how it was composed, and then if you want to ask questions, that's great. The poem is called The Fish Channel, and what you need to know about this is, I grew up in Southern Illinois and there was a little tiny hospital in our town. The town was maybe 25,000 people. And it wasn't a very good hospital. It was kind of a bad hospital. And so my mother thought, well, you know, maybe we should have your father taken to St. Louis, to the hospital up there. So he was taken up to Barnes Hospital up there. And he was there 6 weeks, maybe. Just this whole process of dying is really slow. It's a lot slower than it looks on TV. And so, imagine some of you have experienced somebody in your lives dying as well, and it's very difficult to watch. So we stayed in there was a hotel attached to the hospital for people whose family members were in the hospital. And so we would go back and forth between the tower where the hotel rooms were and the hospital rooms. So this poem is called The Fish Channel. As you were dying, sometimes I went back to the room to catch a nap or a shower. I'd click on the television for an hour, flip around the channels for lack of anything to do but sit by your bed and watch you breathe and breathe, that motion your only language. Some kinds of devotion may take more imagination than mine, bred of simply wanting you to stay. Sitting in front of the screen, watching the chain of bubbles rise, tracking the plane paths, became a kind of sedative, an unremitting way to ease the coming loss. I knew nearly nothing of death, of the way it rings in the numb mind, chiming without end, or how some of the brain's cells will seize on it, sincerely and with the strength of the tides. Channel 7 was its own ocean, a narcotic blue square of water, the fish almost washed from view by the lights behind them, and near the sides, the plants pulled and swayed against the water. Often, I imagined the whole hotel, all those sad, grieving people, sitting on the edges of their beds, staring at the fish channel at once, the water, the bubbles, fish pulsing across the screen. So, I am not generally a formal poet, but this is a poem that rhymes. I don't know if you could hear it as I was reading, because I tried to kind of hide it. I was a little ashamed of the idea that I was rhyming the poem. I'm not sure why. One of the ways I felt that I could contain the emotion that the poem possessed was by finding a formal constraint on myself, a way to control what was going on in the piece. And so after, I don't know how many times, I started trying originally to write this poem without rhyme and without form. And so I would write things and they would sound so sappy and dumb. And I, you know, it just all sounded, you know, very much unlike me. And so at some point, you know, probably after 10 or 11 or 12 drafts of this piece, I realized, oh, I need something to help me through the process of writing this instead of just going at it and not having any structure. So I hit on the idea of figuring out the way to sort of move myself from the end of one line to the next line was using rhyme. And I tried to hide it. I really did try to hide it. So I've rhymed sitting and unremitting and chain and plane and nearly and sincerely, but I worked pretty hard at the rhyme in this poem so that it didn't wasn't so obtrusive. I think the poem altogether took me maybe 4 or 5 months to write. And while I was doing that, I was also, of course, doing other things, writing other things, but I really wanted to get this poem down and have something that was kind of a little monument to my dad. And so finally felt happy with it enough to feel that it was finished, if anything is ever really finished. So there you go.
During their visit to SSU, Shilp and Mock sat down for an interview with Dr. Michelle Rosga, who is a faculty member in the Department of English, Languages, and Cultures, as well as being a poet herself. Here now are a few brief excerpts from the interview, which highlights their origins as writers and provides some insight into the influence of fairy tales on Jeff Mock's work.
Hello. Welcome to Savannah State. We're so happy to have you here on the Georgia Poetry Circuit.
Thank you.
I have this question. I have some general questions I wanted to start out with. And recently, because a student of mine is doing some volunteer work with poetry workshops with kids in town, this organization called DEEP, mm-hmm. I was digging out my copy of Kenneth Koch, Rose, Where Did You Get That Red? Mm-hmm. And so I've been thinking about kids and poetry. So I thought I'd start out and ask you both, do you have a distinct memory of beginning to write when you were a child, or did your writing life start later for you? So I thought, Jeff, would you like to?
The first poem I didn't write myself. I got in trouble for it because I copied a Robert Frost poem, and boy, it must have been third grade, perhaps. Mm-hmm. The teacher wanted us to write poems, and of course, she recognized it immediately as a Robert Frost poem. Mm-hmm. But I didn't start to write that until later, and my parents were going through some trouble that eventually led to a divorce. Mm-hmm. But I started writing then, and you know, I was writing in kind of a poem form, because I wasn't telling a story and I wasn't writing an essay and I was just trying to express things. Mm-hmm. And of course I knew nothing about poetry at the time and all of it I'm sure was pretty awful poetry-wise, but it was helpful for me to write it. Mm-hmm. And that's how I just got started writing. And, uh-huh. and then I started to learn about poetry.
So you started early.
Yeah, so I was 12 or so when uh-huh. I started writing.
Mm-hmm. That's great. How about you, Marco?
I think I was a little older. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was very young, my parents, there was a book about a squirrel, that I had memorized, and my parents thought I was precociously reading, but I wasn't really. I was just, you know, repeating what they had read to me many times. And it sounded, I think, a little like poetry to me. It had, you know, rhythms in it mm-hmm. that I really enjoyed. But I didn't really start writing probably until high school, where I thought it was poetry. And later, mm-hmm. I, you know, had gone back to it and realized it was, I guess, what I would call poetry, but it wasn't very good. You know, I hadn't read anything and hadn't arrived at subjects yet that I mm-hmm. wanted to explore. Mm-hmm. But the impulse to write poems was probably around 16.
Oh, so wonderful. I have a follow-up question to this. Do you have any juvenilia stashed away that you would never show another living soul?
I did until I found it and I discarded it. And I thought nobody should ever see this. Mm-hmm. Juvenilia of other people is interesting. Mm-hmm. But I did not like my juvenilia.
Well, those poems I wrote in high school, I did not save. But after my mother died, I found that she had saved them. And when I was cleaning out my mother's office, I found these folders that had all of these poems. She had saved all of them. Mm-hmm. And so I have them. Mm-hmm. I certainly would never want anyone to see them. So
I can relate to that. I don't know if you've ever read The Mists of Avalon, the Arthurian legend from the female character's point of view. But when I read The Lost Children, I was thinking about, in that book, one of the characters is passing out of the real world into Avalon, and there's this great scene where the character's describing how you can see the two worlds touching, but one world is disappearing, and it's the Avalon, you know, it's the magical side. And I find a lot of elements of fairy tales in some of the poems that I've read of yours, Jeff. And so I was thinking of that, the two worlds side by side, that mythical fairy tale feeling. And I thought I would ask you if you read a lot of fairy tales when you were growing up, and if you remember doing that, and which ones were important to you, and if you feel that that is an influence or...
Oh yeah, fairy tales are definitely an influence. Although I didn't read them growing up. I was, mm-hmm. I was a reader when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And so I read the Arthurian legends and Robin Hood and kind of the adventures swashbuckling. And I became interested in fairy tales when I was in college. And I just sort of stumbled upon them. But, you know, back to kind of Jungian psychology, that idea of these cultural icons that are emblematic for us. And I see those in fairy tales. Yeah. They are part of the stories that our culture is made of. Mm-hmm. And they're different now, of course, because we've tamed them for the children. And so I do like the earlier, darker versions of things. And often that's where the poems go, as they're looking at more the original versions than the more recent, safer versions.
Yes, I noticed that. I love that dark quality put together with the mythical fairy tale quality. Would you like to pick a section from that one to read, or would you prefer not?
No, I'd be happy to.
Okay, I have all the sections here.
I know which one I would like. I just don't know which number it is. Yeah, so the role of the mother in fairy tales mm-hmm. really interests me, and how we substituted stepmother for mother. We could not stand the thought of a mother not having those nurturing instincts. And so this is sort of toward the middle of the poem. The children are waking on that day that they go on to go to the witch's house. So they've been in the forest for a while, all on their own, trying to survive. Mm-hmm. And so it's the third section of The Lost Children. Up from caverns of ash, up from the heaven of worms, up from the hush and from the pit of their hunger, up from dream, up from fear. Thus the third morning breaks and the woods sleep. Somewhere their father descends and they rise. Somewhere their mother takes the blame for our imagination and they rise. Bless her in hunger and bless her in health. Up, together, from a hollow of roots, they rise. And their mother cannot be saved. Thus the third morning breaks, and they walk deeper, and the woods grow to a forest. They walk, bless their mother for their legs. At midday, they see perched on a branch a snow-white bird that sings a song to shame them in their doubt. Bless their mother for their eyes, and bless her for their ears. Where the bird flies, it will follow.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you very much for talking with us, for being here at Savannah State.
Oh, our pleasure.
Thank you.
Looking forward to the reading tonight. So,
as are we.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Before the break, we heard from poets Margot Shilp and Jeff Mock. We continue our celebration of all things poetry by turning now to acclaimed poet Andrea Hollander, who visited Savannah State in February 2016. Hollander has published 5 books of poetry, including Landscape with Female Figure, New and Selected Poems, 1982 through 2012, which was a finalist for the Oregon Book Award in Poetry. Among her other awards and honors are the 2008 Subiaco Award for Literary Merit for Excellence in the Writing and Teaching of Poetry, and a 2007 NEA Fellowship. Please enjoy a selection from Hollander's lecture giving during her visit to SSU, in which she discusses the origin of her life as a poet.
So, I never knew that I was going to be a writer. I was a little girl who grew up, my dad was in the Army. I was conceived in France right after World War II, and I was born in Berlin, Germany, 9 months later. My mother and father are both Americans. They were both born and raised in New Jersey, you've heard of it. But we were living overseas till I was 2 years old. And then we lived in one Army fort or another until I was 8 years old, and that was the time my father got out of active duty, and we moved to New Jersey. So I grew up from age 8 to 17 in New Jersey, and then I went off to college. And even though I did come back to New Jersey for my first year of high school English teaching right after I graduated from college, I was a vagabond in many ways, although I got jobs and taught in Florida, lived in Florida in Sarasota for a year, then went to Texas, then went to Colorado, then went to California. You got the idea. I just thought, because perhaps I was someone who grew up with a move so often, that maybe that's the way you found out what a place was like. You got a job, you moved there, and when you're a teacher, you can get jobs. Well, I don't know how hard it is anymore, but I could then. In any case, it really wasn't until 1970, I was 23 years old. I know you weren't born yet, but I was. Some of you were born, not too many. My mother died unexpectedly. She was 51, much too young, and she was my intimate. I was a little bit afraid of my father, not that he was violent, he wasn't. But he was one of these silent men, and I didn't know always what he thought, and when he thought something negative, I was in trouble, but not because he hit me, but he gave me the silent treatment. My mother, on the other hand, could navigate the waters between me and my dad. Plus, she had the answer for everything. When I was first having crushes on boys, she would help me navigate how those feelings ought to be acted upon or not acted upon, and she was just great. My friends used to come over to the house because they liked my mother's advice as well. So you get the idea. We were close. So when she died at 51 and I was 23, well, my father was devastated, but my mother died of cancer, and he was a doctor by that time. He's a guy who almost he almost flunked out of high school, and that's a whole story in itself that I'll tell another time. But eventually, he got an education through the Army and even went to medical school and became a doctor. Well, he knew then that she was not going to make it, but I didn't. And so, even though both of us were devastated, he had really worked through his grief while she was dying, and I had no idea until she died that she was going to die. even though I knew she had cancer. And this was years before there was even chemotherapy or anything like that. So I will say that her death gave birth to my life as a poet. And the reason that that happened is it was really hard for me to not be able to talk to my dad about something that he didn't want to deal with anymore. Also, I wasn't living near him by then. I was up in Massachusetts and he was still in New Jersey. And I found myself going to bookstores and looking at books of poetry and going to the library in Boston and looking for books of poetry. And the reason I was doing that was because poetry was the place where human beings like us articulate deep feeling in language. We all feel things, but not all of us have the language to articulate what we feel in a way that other people can appreciate and actually inhabit. And so I was finding that I was reading poems and I was also writing poems. Well, I wouldn't say they were very good poems, they weren't, but you write your grief when you are struck with something personal. You don't have to admit this, but I will bet that anytime something has happened in your life that's emotional, traumatic, that some of you have gone to writing about it in some way, writing a poem. I can tell you that when in 2001, when we had the attack on the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon, there were more people writing poems than had ever been writing poems before, for at least 10 years before that. People who never thought of themselves as writers. So it's not unusual that I would, out of a trauma, a personal trauma, find myself trying to write poems and also reading good poems. Good poems, what I mean by that is they were, they felt as though the words that were being spoken were my words. And even though I would read these poems over and over again, I knew what the journey of the reading would be. I knew where it was going to start, where it was going to end, and yet it felt as though I was speaking in words I didn't have. And I knew that there was an art there that what I was writing didn't have. So what's the difference? How do you get from writing your heart out to writing something that other people can say, wow, that's exactly what I feel, in language that's memorable and language that's musical? So I decided one day that in order to write as well as the poets that I was reading, I needed to learn the craft behind the art. And let me make one analogy. You've seen magicians, whether you saw them in live or saw them on TV or saw them in a film, right? You know what a magician is, making magic tricks. Well, I suggest that for me, at least, during this many years of apprenticeship, I was 23 when I started doing this. I'm 68 now. You do the math, so you'll figure out how many years I've been doing this. But at that 23-year-old naive self, I decided that the poems that I fell in love with were actually magic tricks performed by a master magician. Otherwise, how could they last so long? And how could I read them every time and feel my whole body come alive in some emotional spot that I couldn't quite touch with my own language? Well, I think, okay, that is a magic trick. And my job as an aspiring magician, you get the analogy, is to figure out the trick, because no master magician gives it away. Even in the world of magic, and I know some people who are magicians, the master magicians will perform the trick as many times as you want to see it to the aspiring students, but they won't tell how it's done. You've got to figure that out. So I did that, and I still do that. I read poetry. I try to figure out what is going on here. Why is this poem so powerful? Well, I might notice, for example, that the powerful poem, if I look just at the verbs tell the story of the narrative part of the poem by themselves. and my poems were using words like is, was, has been, went, go, move. No imagery there. Nothing to move anybody. But the powerful poems were using words like amble, fist, rush, simmer. You get it? I mean, words that actually mean something and move somewhere. Okay, so that was how I learned to write. I spent 10 years just writing and reading and writing, reading and writing, and it wasn't for 10 years of learning how to make my efforts better and better and better that I sent some poems out to what I thought were the best literary journals in the country. And the first one I sent to was the Georgia Review in Athens, Georgia. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm here now, because I know that the Georgia Review is part of this Georgia poetry circuit, and I know that someone had to nominate me to be on this circuit. And I saw, okay, well, it's possibly them because they keep publishing me. And that's been since 1982, and this is a long time later. A couple of editors in as well.
You just heard part of a lecture from Oregon-based poet Andrea Hollander. Next, we'll listen to an interview with Hollander conducted by Dr. Stephanie Cartolopoulos, a poet who teaches in SSU's Department of English, Languages, and Cultures. Here, we will gather more insight into Hollander's poetry and learn what advice she has to offer any young writers who may be listening.
Hi, welcome everyone. My name is Dr. Stephanie Cartolopoulos. I teach at Savannah State's English Department, and I'm here with Andrea Hollander. Andrea Hollander, one of Georgia Poetry Circuit's 2016 poets, has published 4 chapbooks and 4 full-length volumes of poetry. Most recently, Landscape with a Female Figure, New and Selected Poems, 1982 to 2012. Hollander's poems, essays, and reviews have appeared in dozens of periodicals and anthologies, and she edited When She Named Fire, an anthology of contemporary poetry by American women. Her many awards include 2 NEA fellowships in poetry and the Nicholas Roerich Poetry Prize. Longtime writer in residence at Lyon College in Arkansas, Hollander currently lives in Portland, Oregon, where she teaches for the Attic Institute in the Mountain Writer Series. Welcome.
Thanks.
I'm so happy to have you. Mm-hmm. Okay, now I want to talk a little bit about some of your poems. As I was reading your work, I noticed that you tend to use a lot of everyday images, you know, things that people can think as, you know, mundane or not the stuff that you would write poetry about, like what surrounds a person in a hotel room or a small boat made of popsicle sticks, right? So much of your work seems to invite very easy and natural observation with the everyday world and just shoots from there into maybe more emotional territory. Can you talk about the kinds of images that inspire you or speak to you and that always just seem right in your work?
Yes. For one thing, I believe that my readership, my ideal reader, mm-hmm. is someone who doesn't think that poetry is necessary to his or her life. Mm-hmm. And I want to use the language of the visual or experiential language mm-hmm. of those people's lives, which is my life. As a young person, I never would have considered that I'd ever be a writer because my life wasn't dramatic in any way.
Yeah.
And Hemingway and Faulkner and all these very famous people, Dickinson, who was the recluse,
yeah.
there's something dramatic about their stories. I grew up in a family that was ordinary. My parents loved each other. They stayed married. Mm-hmm. They loved me. I knew I was loved. Nothing, quote unquote, bad happened. But I think that's my inspiration, mm-hmm. that ordinary life matters to all of us. Eventually, when my mother passed away young, that started me on the path of serious attention to the craft of poetry. I wrote because I was writing out of grief, but I wrote, but I taught myself the craft because I knew that I wouldn't succeed in any way other than therapeutic ways if I didn't learn something about the craft. So
I use the world around me mm-hmm. as inspiration and material, because that is all that really we share, I and anyone who doesn't think of poetry as necessary to her or his life. So that's where I begin, and the life experience that we all share, that ordinary, the ordinary objects in our lives, the ordinary curtains on the window, the ordinary sidewalk that goes out to the street where cars are parked, the dust on the parking meters, the envelope you pick up from the ground that has someone's grocery list and also says something about the dog going to the vet. Something about that touches me. Just ordinary stuff. And then the ordinary world, concentrate on that, use your imagination, and eventually it makes its way into something that's deeper than what we observe.
That's great. Yeah, that's right. Okay, well, one more question, because I know that we're running short on time. Let's think about the young writer, like the students who you taught at, what, Lyon College, was that? Yes, at Lyon College, and the students here at SSU who are just getting excited about poetry. A lot of times the advice that people give poets or young poets is write what you know. Mm-hmm. What advice would you have for the young poet?
Well, I'm going to give you two bits of advice,
great.
And part of it because Lisa, who was talking earlier, asked me to make sure I talked about my sense of how to go about looking at other people's poems. So I'm going to give both of those. So my advice is you already know what you know.
Yeah.
I don't think you need to write what you know. I think you have to write what you didn't know that you knew.
Okay.
And how do you find out what you didn't know that you knew? You start with something you don't know anything about. Mm-hmm. And that's why I will sometimes give myself the assignment of I open a book of poetry, I read somebody else's poem, and I pretend that that poem is a question that my poem has to answer, but not on the same subject. For example, I might be reading a poem about a woman who is, maybe she's punishes her kids mm-hmm. all the time. Okay, so I'm going to write about not a woman, but a man, and I'm going to write a man who rewards his kids all the time. I don't know anybody necessarily who does that, so I'm creating a fiction. And then that might, suddenly I find out, I might realize as I write that I'm thinking about somebody I actually do know. And maybe it's somebody I didn't think about as someone who gave pleasure. And so I'm discovering something about something I don't know, and then I find out, oh, but I actually do know. Yeah. It wasn't something I knew that I knew.
Or even like your poem, Ogre, it's that moment where the lips shape the formation for the O to come out, right?
That's right.
And that leads to some other kind of awareness and understanding.
Exactly.
And there comes that point where you're very intimately aware
right.
of something that you didn't really think about or that
right.
you wouldn't come or that wouldn't come to mind very
right.
quickly.
Well, the other kinds of advice on that same
mm-hmm.
subject is I might say to someone, I've had, let's say, a girl come into my office when I was teaching at
yeah.
the college and say, I want to write about my breakup with my boyfriend,
yeah.
but I can't do it because I'm so angry.
Yeah.
And I say, okay, so let's make your boyfriend, he's dark-haired, let's make him blonde, and let's write a poem from his point of view. What was the last time you had a good time with him? And she'll tell me, and I say, okay, it's taking place on that corner while you're waiting for the bus, but he's speaking
mm-hmm.
the poem. And so it
yeah.
just takes it away from, okay, she knows the scene, but she doesn't know what he thinks.
Mm-hmm.
And if she makes him a slightly different person, he could say anything he wants
mm-hmm.
or think anything he wants.
Yeah.
So it's just changing things a little bit.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
And the one other thing that I want to make sure I
mm-hmm.
listen to Lisa and tell you.
Yeah.
The other bit of advice is to keep reading poetry if you want to be a poet. Read fiction if you want to be a fiction writer, but I also think that writers should not limit themselves and say, I'm only going to be a poet, I'm only
yeah.
going to do this. But it's the way I approached my own apprenticeship to poetry writing. I don't have a master's of fine arts in poetry. I taught myself, so to speak, but no differently from the way artists, visual artists, taught themselves. They apprenticed to somebody if they could. If not, they went to museums and saw
yeah.
work. So I approach any poem that I've fallen in love with as if it were a magic trick performed by a master magician.
Okay.
And I am an aspiring magician who must learn the trick, figure it out, because a master magician doesn't tell you how the trick is done. So that's the way I approach learning from other poems and other poets, even the dead ones. Mm-hmm. What is the trick? I don't know. I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to look at, oh, this is a 10-line poem, but it's made up of a single sentence. How did you do that? Well, I first noticed that you wrote a one-sentence poem, and where are the end words of the lines? If I read just the verbs out loud, I see that I could get a sense of the whole poem. And then I look at my poems and I think, oh, boring verbs. How will I do that? So it's learning by imitation and attention.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for spending some time with us today. And I'm here with Andrea Hollander, whose most recent book is A Landscape with a Female Figure. It's a new and selected poems of her work since 1982. Thank you for spending some time here at SSU.
Thank you for bringing me to Savannah.
Absolutely.
My first time, and I love it already.
Welcome back to Poetry in the Air. Before the break, we heard an interview with Andrea Hollander, award-winning poet and teacher. Next, we'll hear from a number of SSU students and faculty reading their work, as well as the work of a couple more well-known poets. First is a reading of odes recorded during Hispanic Heritage Week in fall 2015, including the poem Ode to Clothing, written by Nobel Prize-winning Chilean poet Pablo Neruda, and read in both the original Spanish and in English translation by SSU student Nicole Font and SSU professor and poet Dr. Chad Ferries. Also included are the original poems An Ode to My Heels by SSU student Janae Waring and Ode to Pink Snuggie by SSU alumna Tanisha Pugh Graham.
Oda al Traje por Pablo Neruda. Cada mañana esperas traje sobre una silla que te llene mi vanidad, mi amor, mi esperanza, mi cuerpo. Apenas salgo del sueño, me despido del agua, entro en tus mangas, mis piernas buscan el hueco de tus piernas. Y así abrazado por tu fidelidad infatigable, salgo a pisar el pasto.
Each morning you are waiting, my clothing, on a chair. For me to fill you with my vanity, my love, my hope, my body. I hardly have gotten out of sleep. I say goodbye to the water. I enter your sleeves, my legs, look for the hollowness of your legs, and so embraced by your tireless faithfulness, I go out to walk in the grass.
Entro en la poesía, miro por las ventanas, las cosas, los hombres, las mujeres. Los hechos y las luchas me van formando, me van haciendo frente, labrándome las manos, abriéndome los ojos, gastándome la boca, y así traje, yo también voy formándote, sacándote los codos, rompiéndote los hilos, y así tu vida crece a imagen de mi vida.
I enter into poetry. I look through windows at things. Men, women, deeds, and struggles keep forming me, keep coming against me, laboring with my hands, opening my eyes, using my mouth, and so clothing. I also keep forming you, poking out your elbows, snapping your threads, and so your life grows into the image of my life.
Al viento ondulas y resuenas como si fueras mi alma. En los malos minutos te adhieres a mis huesos vacíos. Por la noche, la oscuridad, el sueño, pueblan con sus fantasmas, tus alas y las mías. Yo pregunto si un día una bala del enemigo te dejará una mancha de mi sangre, y entonces te morirás conmigo.
In the wind, you ripple and rustle as if you were my soul. And in bad minutes, you stick to my bones, empty, through the night, darkness, sleep, populate with their fantasies your wings and mine. And I ask if one day a bullet from the enemy might leave a spot of blood on you, and then you would die with me.
O tal vez no sea todo tan dramático, sino simple, y te irás enfermando, traje, conmigo, envejeciendo conmigo, con mi cuerpo, y juntos entraremos a la tierra. Por eso cada día te saludo con reverencia y luego me abrazas y te olvido, porque uno solo somos y seguiremos siendo, frente al viento, en la noche, las calles o la lucha, un solo cuerpo, tal vez, alguna vez inmóvil.
Or maybe it won't all be so dramatic, but simple, and you'll just get feeble clothing, with me growing old, with me, with my body, and together we will enter the earth. That's why every day I greet you with reverence, and then you embrace me, and I forget you, because we are just one, and we'll keep going on together against the wind and the night, the streets or the struggle, one single body. Maybe, maybe, sometime we'll be immobile.
I'll be reading An Ode to My Heels by me. It's that extra lift that raises you higher to God, man-made perfection that sparks the engine in every woman's step. The way your feet shine like the rubies against the night sky. It gives me that come hither attitude with suggestive behavior. Its straps are accented with gold that has the strength of an ox, but poised like a giselle. The sounds of click-clack is music to my ears. That beat that's unforgettable, that bass to any song. Click-clack, click-clack as I move on. A stride so calculating that it's like stalking prey like a lion in its own habitat. Oh, my pumps, you put a great distance between me and others. My feet yearn for your initial hug. It's addictive. You slim me and make me better. I wonder what other ventures you will bring me. I only ask what's next.
Good morning. This is called Ode to Pink Snuggie. This pink snuggie at the foot of my comforter used to be my mother's that she snuggled against. For movies, for cold nights, sick days, pink snuggie stayed, comforting her heart and easing her mind into relaxation. That pink snuggie protected away from the day's harsh stresses. This pink snuggie at the foot of my comforter comforts me the way it used to comfort my mommy.
We're going to continue playing poetry authored by members of the Savannah State community. Here are poems written and read by students Samantha Thompson and Lenaris Zanders.
Going by the social media name Samantha Hiley, I have taken my love for words with a vengeance. It wasn't until I had my first heart-mangling experience that I truly understand my purpose in this world, to speak for the unspoken. I write poetry and short stories stemming from anything that inspires me. After having a few pieces published on FromAWildflower.com, I realized I wanted to create my own corner on the internet for my work. It's My Silver Lining is a blog I created for women. With poetry, short stories, natural hair tips, food posts, wellness, and above all, inspiration. Mostly for women who are looking to find their smile. I have been through a lot and I know some women can relate. However, my goal is to show them that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. Storms don't last, and above all, always look for the silver lining. It's hard raising a child on two dimes and a nickel. Filling her belly with canned peas and icicles, it's hard. Doing anything for dollar signs, hiding behind tear-filled eyes, constantly trying to protect her innocent life. It is my duty, my pleasure, my purpose, never my curse, to take pride in your full belly, smiling face, and all your firsts. But why am I subjected to do it alone? Why is a third generation the only father figure you have known? No shade. But a father is either going to be a rock or a rolling stone. There is no in-between. I just hope my single motherhood is a phase and I am not subjected genetically. Because I can't bear the thought of an empty home, me at work and you alone, fending for yourself as I work my fingers to the bone. Always too tired to play, to listen and to teach, failing to speak and to practice what I preach. Then time repeats itself and another one bites the dust. My crime would be knowing that I could have helped, but maintaining the material was a must. There she sits, perched on the couch like a feline, stacked up there in a way where every curve and every line looks delectable. Laughing at his jokes, a smile here, a dimple there, a peak of gleaming pearly whites always. She is perfect, not in a literal sense because beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Perfection is in her pores, saturating her heart and feeding her soul. She gets it. Womanhood. She understands things beyond beautiful smells and painted lips. She understands how to nurture beyond hugs and how to love without words. This soft perfection took time to manifest. The life she lived exfoliated her to a soft, smooth glow. She is powerful with grace, and without boast, she is wise. I love her. The sad part is that she was always here, laughing at my jokes, touching my heart, and wiping the sweat from my brow. But that is why I love her, because she understands. She understands the now, and she lives for the forever. She.
My name is Lenard Sanders. I'm a sophomore. I'm a piano major, and I will be reading We Are and Believe. The name of this piece is We Are. I breathe, I think, I see. My heart beats. I live, just as the prisoner does. Though he's locked away, he breathes, he thinks, he sees. He lives. And who's to say I'm not locked away? Mentally, spiritually, physically, what determines my freedom? What governs the value of his life and mine? Am I better than the prisoner, locked away for fraud, theft, murder? Do actions really determine one's true value? And are all actions equal? I respect him, the prisoner. I respect him because he, like me, lives. He, like me, dies. He, like me, is. Who in this world is better than me? Who in this world is better than the person standing next to them? We've experienced joy, heartbreak, love, loss. Each and every being has felt. What makes you better than me? Consider for a short moment the blue whale. Majestic, harmonious, tranquil. The whale breathes, thinks, sees. Its heart beats. The blue whale lives. What makes you better than the blue whale? The name of this piece is titled Believe. They left again today, my mother, my sister. I awake and there she is, slipping her pink flip-flops on her feet. She seems so gentle from head to toe. My sister, innocent without a care. She loved my mother and my mother her. Or was it just a need? My mother, caring. I remember her voice, strong and smooth. She sang and I sat to listen, admiration while she belted to the beat. Though today I wouldn't hear her sing. I watched as the engine to our brand new car smoothly started, and in the headlights shining the sun substitute. Rubbing my eyes, I peered out the window, sneakily gazing as they drove out of sight. The stories were true, though I wouldn't believe. Believed empty cabinet bearing two or three cans. Believed the barren fridge dirty with molded cheese. Believed the missing PSP, my PSP. Mom took it because she said I was bad, said she'd give it back. That was 6 years ago. I wouldn't believe she had taken to crack. I could have helped you seek a thrill. We could have went to the zoo or learned to swim. We could have rode bikes or made finger puppets with flashlights. You could have read me stories or played board games, but that was all a fantasy. Parents didn't do this. Drugs were their thrill. But my little sister, why must she attend your horror sessions? Getting blazed out of your mind, who looked after her? She was only 9. 9, such a precious age. Questions fleet my brain, but my heart keeps my mouth filtered, making me want to go insane. Where were you when she called your name? Did she cry, scream, beg for mercy? Did you trade her for crack? My little sister, quiet and calm, resistant and stubborn, weak and fragile, were you safe? My lost old mother, skinny and dark, shaken and beaten, find your way. Your voice so scratched. I won't be here to hear you sing your song. Set fire to these memories. Someone hand me a match.
The poems we'll play for you today to end the show are Mirrored Hats by SSU student Shaniqua Brown, Persian Royalty by SSU student Simone Roll, and The Gift of Time by SSU staff Megan Gerard. They are the winners of the 2016 Pink Chip Poetry Contest, an annual event sponsored by Asa H. Gordon Library and the QEP at Savannah State University during National Poetry Month. The poetry contest is open to students, faculty, and staff members. Contestants are asked to write a poem using the color words provided on a paint chip. Please enjoy.
My name is Shaniqua Brown. I am an English major here at Savannah State. The name of my poem is called Mirrored Hats. My grandmother loved the color purple. She always personified the color, aged to perfection like the deep Merlot she made from scratch. She often showed me hats made of shades of winter. Open hat boxes of mothballs will occupy my nostrils, contrasting her favorite fragrance of passion fruit. I loved the stories they told, which is why I kept them after her departure. Not based solely on the stories they told, but because they were purple, her favorite color all the way through. Befitting, it became a favorite in my lifetime as I aged in her grace too.
Persian Royalty. As the horn started to blow in preparation of his arrival, every head started to bow in reverence. The king's son was finally of age and was exceedingly ready to take his place. He was now the new crown royal. Emerging from the dark abyss behind the red velvet curtains now drawn, he eloquently made his way to the forbidden royal chair. His tall stature hovered over his trusty servants. He was drenched from head to toe in Persian gold. This prince was surely a gilded young man. It could be seen as he gently descended onto his throne. As he sat, his servants then bustled quickly to his feet, waiting, willing, and ready for their orders. A highly respected priest then entered, in his hand a small red and gold ginger jar. As he opened it, the sweet smell of Indian spices flooded the room, indicating that the ceremony was near its end. He dipped his elderly hand in the jar and withdrew some spices with his fingers. The priest then proceeded to anoint the prince on his head, hands, and feet. When done, the priest slowly retreated, his duties now relinquished. The prince then slowly arose from his seated position, standing tall, robust, and proud, for he was now the new crowned royal.
I'm Megan Gerard. I'm the staff writer at Savannah State University in the Marketing and Communications Department. And this is my poem for the Paint Chip Poetry Contest, and it's called A Gift of Time. Snap. A warm glow dies, and the room is dusty dark. Liquid specimens peer out from their jars. Creatures freeze mid-pounce. This curious collection, this unusual arc, neatly labeled and sorted. Cases of Marrakesh brown and panels of wavy worn glass. Fingering the new pocket watch, a gift of brushed trinket gold, he was their Noah. He no longer needs to know the time. Skeleton key left on the desk, a hand on the comforting knob. He locks the door behind him.
And with that, we conclude our special National Poetry Month episode of Poetry in the Air. We appreciate you tuning in, and we hope you enjoyed listening to the poets talk about and read their work. I wish to thank those who helped make this show possible, including the Georgia Poetry Circuit, poets Margot Shilp, Jeff Mock, and Andrea Hollander, local poets and faculty members Dr. Chad Ferries, Dr. Michelle Rosga, and Dr. Stephanie Cartolopoulos, as well as staff member Megan Gerard, SSU alumna Tanisha Pugh Graham, and SSU students Nicole Font, Janae Waring, Samantha Thompson, Lenaris Sanders, Shaniqua Brown, and Simone Rowe. Thanks also to the QEP's own Adriana de Oliveira and Dr. Lisa Yant, as well as Dr. Ryan Clark for his help in production, and Grace Curry at WHCJ for her support. Have a pleasant day and tune in next time for another episode of Poetry in the Air. I am your host, Sierra Walton. Don't forget that you can listen to all of the Right Attitude radio shows by visiting the Quality Enhancement Plan website, qep.savannahstate.edu. Also, please follow us on Facebook at WriteSSU, Twitter at WriteSSU, and Instagram at Write_SSU.